Welcome everyone, wherever you are around the world. My name is Henrik Palmgren, and you are, of course, listening to Red Ice Radio with headquarters in Sweden. If you're new to the program, we urge you to look at our websites for much more information about the program, what kind of topics and areas we cover, and with what intention we do so. New programs three times per week, redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com. Subscribe to our RSS feeds, and we'll have the program delivered directly to you as soon as they are available. Today we have Timothy Good on the program, worldwide research, interviewing key witnesses and discussing the subject with astronauts, military and intelligent specialists, pilots, politicians and scientists, has established Timothy Good as a leading authority on UFOs and the alien presence. He became interested in the subject in 1955, when his passion for aviation and space led him to read a book by Major Donald Kehoe describing UFO sightings by qualified observers such as military and civilian pilots. In 1961, after reading a book by Captain Edward Ruppelt, a U.S. Air Force intelligence officer, he began to conduct his own research. Timothy has lectured at universities, schools, and at many organizations. In January 1989, following the dissolution of the Soviet Empire, he became the first UFO researcher from the West to be interviewed on Russian television. He was invited for discussions at the Pentagon in 1998 and at the headquarters of the French Air Force in 2002. He has also acted as a consultant for several U.S. Congress investigations. Timothy is probably best known for his bestsellers Above Top Secret, The Worldwide UFO Cover-Up, Beyond Top Secret, Need to Know, UFOs, the Military and Intelligence, and today we're going to discuss his latest book, Earth, an Alien Enterprise. Welcome back, Timothy. Great to have you with us again. We did a program back in 2011, so it was a couple of years ago, but it's good to talk to you again. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Excellent. Now, you have a new book out, of course, Earth, an Alien Enterprise. Really interesting book.
Indeed,
I've been going through.
I haven't seen it myself yet. I gather you've got a copy ahead of me. But
how did that happen? Oh, that's interesting.
So, no, I'm looking forward to seeing it.
Yeah.
I hope I get it pretty soon. But, well, this book, it's published by Pegasus Books in New York, and it should be in the shops and, of course, available online quite shortly, later this month. But I must say, it was probably the hardest book I've ever written. Certainly in terms of time, it took me 2.5 years to get through it, to get through the manuscript. So I devoted a lot of time to it.
Why was it so difficult?
Because I was dealing with some very complicated facets of the subject, very, very complicated ones indeed, like the so-called Amicizia case, which I touch on as one complete chapter devoted to it. It's a very long chapter. I'll explain what that one was. Amicizia means friendship in Italian. And this was a saga comprising a very large group of hand-picked people from all over the world who for 40 years liaised with a group of aliens and sometimes traveled in their spacecraft, some of which were not only lent to us, but given to us. And I'm giving an overview here. You can cross-question me if you like. But
sure.
The object of the exercise was to counter a serious threat to Earth posed by other groups of aliens. And I have had this confirmed by reliable sources from several different countries that this is the most serious problem facing Earth, the threat by other species who do not have our best interests at heart. In the case of the Amicizia, these were highly developed, spiritually, whatever way you want to think. I mean, these were beings, I would say, thousands of years ahead of us, but genetically related to us, who were actually responsible for hybridizing us in the first place. So we are genetically linked to them. They have a vested interest in Earth because Earth is obviously not unique in the galaxy, but from what I gather, it's unique in this particular neck of the woods, which is why it receives the attention of other races. And my information from several seriously informed sources is that the object of the exercise of those who do not have our best interests at heart, namely a certain grey species — there are more than one type of greys, we mustn't tar them with all the same brush, so to speak.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But some of them, unfortunately, do not have our best interests at heart. And it is my information from one Washington source and one European-based source that the object of the exercise has been, since the 1940s, to produce a hybridized race of a mix of their species and ours. And this has been going on since the 1940s, and allegedly they have huge underground bases where these evil little buggers have been abducting us, getting genetic material from us, and producing hybrids. And I've been told that some of these hybrids have made some sort of progress. I think this has been going on for a very long time. I've no idea what the current situation is like, but that is what I have been told, and that is what poses a threat, because these guys wish to take over this planet by producing hybrids, which would be more adaptable here, because they themselves are not adapted. And in my book, I've got a lot of medical information about these guys, I mean, to the nth degree,
yeah.
which we needn't go into here in great detail, but that is the problem. That's the bad news. The good news is that we are being helped by alien species with whom we are genetically linked, and who have, as I say, not only they've lent us, some of them have given us their craft, and we have been flying them for decades. I don't know if you're aware of this. I may have mentioned it in Amsterdam at the conference there, but
yeah.
My information is that quite a number of the astronauts were actually flying alien craft even in the 1960s and 1970s. Gordon Cooper was one, and a close friend of his told me that Cooper actually told him that he, Gordon Cooper, was getting so frustrated with the attitude of the United Nations to the subject when he gave a presentation there in 1978, that he said, "I'm actually prepared to fly an alien craft to the UN building if necessary," to prove the point. Of course, he never did. But
right.
The NASA is just a cover for the real space program, which is controlled by United States Air Force Space Command.
Right. Mm-hmm.
We have a problem, and I can't give you an update, because I've no idea myself what's going on right now, except that, you know, there is a problem. As if we don't have enough.
Well, exactly, yeah. Yeah. Thanks for that one, yeah.
I mean, God, you know, I was watching television last night about Syria, and
yeah.
I was just so horrified by what
sure.
I saw that I had to turn it off. I mean, I've never seen anything like it. I mean, human beings are all Syrians, all killing each other. Children being machine gunned, bombs dropped on them. I've never seen it. I just couldn't watch it all. It was absolutely heartbreaking. And, you know...
Yeah, well, we have to take the media, as you know, Timothy, we have to take everything we see on TV with a grain of salt as well.
Well, there is that.
Yeah.
But I think with Syria, it's an exception.
Yeah, well, I wanted to ask you a little bit more here then, because you obviously it's a big shocker opening you're making here right away, and we want to talk more about that with you here. You call the Amishitsia case, if you will, in the book, the most extraordinary case that you've investigated, but also at times it's outrageous, farcical, and even ludicrous, but you've been compelled to it. Tell us, because last time we talked with you, you mentioned it briefly, and I think we're just kind of heading into it at that point, but obviously something has, you know, the scales have tipped for you, if you will, and you're now a believer, I guess we could call it, of the case. Tell us more about it.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I had the pleasure of becoming friends with a great guy called Professor Stefano Breccia. Sadly, he died like a couple of years ago, well, maybe 18 months ago.
2012, I believe, yeah.
Prematurely, and myself and my girlfriend had been out on two occasions to Italy to interview him over several days, and he kindly gave me a great deal of information, including extremely detailed technological information. He himself had flown in these craft on a couple of occasions. He's taken close-up photographs of them. And incidentally, there are photographs of some of the aliens produced, one of which is in the book. At least I hope to goodness it is, because it's the most important photograph showing a 10-foot-tall alien who was attached to the Amicizia group. And the photograph was taken by a respected Catholic historian, Bruno Samicizia. So there was a lot going on, and Stefano, who had been a pilot, he was a scientist, he traveled all over the world meeting people working with the Amicizia groups, and he himself had he lectured at several universities, not on the subject, I hasten to add, but I mean, he was a very respected scientist. And he gave me so much information, including highly detailed technological information about exactly how the craft are propelled. So that I think, you know, I can't elaborate on all that right now, but there's a lot of detail. And as I say, the object of the exercise, there were, just to complicate the whole issue, there were mm-hmm. three groups of aliens involved in the Amicizia group, and there were the good guys, who definitely have our best interests at heart, but they said that there were others here, human types, who were half robotic and half human, who were creating
really?
Problems. And in Italian, Stefano, they called them the contraries, the enemy who was against us.
Like a cyborg, if you will.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yes. Yes.
Interesting. Okay.
I mean, there were people from all walks of life who were involved, and they were all hand-picked people from universities, scientists, engineers, doctors, business people, including heads of huge communications organizations. And as I say, quite a number of these people were flying these craft. And Stefano, on one occasion, I know that he told me he went with a German friend in one of the aliens' craft. Everything, incidentally, was being monitored by them. they weren't about to let the craft crash or anything. In fact, they're very difficult to crash.
Mm-hmm.
But there was Stefano told me he went on a trip in one with this German friend who was piloting it, and Stefano was taking notes. And they flew from Italy to Cairo, and then from Cairo to Moscow, and back from Moscow to Italy, you know, like in an hour or something like that.
Okay.
Might have been a bit longer, but everything was being monitored by the Amicizia aliens, just in case anything went wrong. The interesting thing is, I questioned Stefano about whether the military were flying some of these things, because I have an American source who's given me information which I have published in the book. I have not mentioned my source's name. One can't
right.
do that.
Yep.
That you know, the astronauts, some of the astronauts I talked about earlier, have been flying these craft for quite some time. Our own pilots have been flying them. And Stefano told me that he was aware of 10 Italian Air Force pilots who had flown these craft. And he gave some amusing stories to me about that. So
mm-hmm.
this was going on years ago, starting, well, let me think. I mean, probably started about 50 years ago or more.
Right.
And it all sort of fizzled out a bit over the years. And I don't know whether they're still around. I have no idea at all. But I know that they were in many countries, Argentina, Chile, the US, Europe, starting around in the 1950s, I would say, late 1950s.
There's a lot of questions I have about this. So if they, you know, we want to talk what happened if they're not even around today, but how did they get a hold of these crafts then, first of all?
Oh, the aliens let us fly them.
they were here and like they handed over the keys to the car kind of thing. Here you go.
They've got bases. You know, some of the bases are like 150 miles long underneath the oceans or underneath the earth and various. And those bases can be created very, very quickly. Their technology is such as that they can impact material or practically instantaneously with their technology, so that a base can be made, the earth can be dealt with in such a way that it creates a huge area, which is protected by the impacted ground, which is triply dense after being expanded underground, and these bases are used there. And a lot of activities went on there, apparently. I think one of the bases was at least 150 miles in length. They had a lot of, Stefano Tobi didn't go into details, but he said they had a lot of technological machinery down there, but I don't know what that was.
Now, let me just clarify one thing here. Sorry if the stupid question then, but the Amicizia group, are they the ones, you know, who had access to these bases, basically, that were involved in this with the good guys?
Yes. I mean, the whole outfit was called Amicizia or W-56.
Okay.
Because they'd actually first established communications with George Washington donkeys years ago. I mean, 1956 was for the year they started collaborating with people in different countries. And the W was for Washington because they allegedly briefed George Washington, the first president of the United States, about the alien situation. So that I found very, very interesting that they were in touch with us then.
Tell me a little bit about what it was with the testimony from both Stefano and other people that you talked about that convinced you, I guess, because last time you were still on the fence about this. What happened? Have you seen more things, maybe even than you can talk about in your book and here, or is it still just a testimony of these people that convinced you?
Just remind me, when was the conference? Was it like 2.5 years ago or something like that?
2011 in, was it April?
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah.
I think I was with Stefano in 2010. For the first time, at any rate, and may have come back the following year. I'm not sure. With my girlfriend, and she speaks Italian, so that helped a lot. But Stefano speaks very good English, as well. So it's just that we were given. I mean, I don't know what aspects in particular would you like me to expand on, if I can. I mean, it's such a huge.
Well, yeah, and I know well as much as possible. I guess I'm curious. We talked, just to clarify that, by the way, last time, Timothy, in February. 24th in 2011, and then we mentioned it briefly. You said it's a very interesting case and all that, and then consequently, you visited more with the group, correct? Different people from it and researched it more.
A few different people. Yes, I didn't get to meet as many as I would have liked, but I did get to know some, like Paolo Di Girolamo, a delightful man.
Yeah.
And of course, because he'd had some experience, he never saw the craft close up, but he saw some of the small anii, as they called them, the very small, very, very small sort of objects, which were probes of some kind, which would be released into the atmosphere. Or in one case, he was in a car, and these things were just following the car, and they were buzzing all around. Very small things, about smaller than a golf ball.
Hmm.
And that's all he never actually encountered the visitors to my knowledge, but Paolo, but Stefano certainly did, and he was working with them over 40 years, I guess.
Yeah. Now, okay, back to that question again, how you became a believer. If this is testimony, you've met with a lot
of
people.
First of all, I would say, getting to know Stefano, I've never met anybody so honest and straightforward.
Right.
Quite frankly, I would have trusted him with my life. That's what clinched it for me. That's why I had to meet him, because he was the one that wrote the book Mass Contacts.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the book is rather muddled the way it's put together. I mean, it really does need a good editor. I think somebody. I think it's Warren Aston in Australia is doing a sort of edited version of it. with some additional information, which I believe is actually available. And he's a very bright guy, and he's met some of the Amicizia people. It's a very, very complex case. I mean, I don't pretend to have grasped the whole ramifications yet, I must say, but I don't think it's going on. That's for sure. That it's not going on right now, as far as I know.
So what happened?
They allegedly left. Stefanos told me he wasn't convinced by but allegedly there was some kind of underwater in the Adriatic Sea. The facts of the matter are, it was all in the newspapers. I mean, the sea went absolutely berserk, and I think a couple of sailors and fishermen were killed in the event. So some people died, and nobody could explain why the water suddenly went absolutely berserk. And apparently there was this tremendous underground battle between the so-called contraries and the good guys, the Amicizia group. Stefano was very skeptical about all that. He thought they were just creating an excuse to leave, because they were getting, some of them were getting a bit less than pleased with a number of the people that they were being in contact with. And there were all sorts of dividing lines, and there were these contraries who were causing a tremendous chaos between the rival groups. There were supposed to be about three groups in altogether, I believe. I don't have the chapter in front of me, but you know, feel free to open the book. It's a very long chapter.
Yeah, exactly. It is. I'm finding certain things here as well as we're talking and looking at my notes. But if we stick to what we're talking about here now for a moment, then who did Stefano talk with? Where did he get his information from?
He got his information directly from the aliens since the late 1950s.
Yeah.
He wasn't one of the first, but he, you know, like within a few years of the Enterprise starting, he became deeply involved.
And then he died in 2012, I think, sometime September, I believe. And what do you know about what has happened consequently? Is there any other people that still are active in the group that you can contact and talk with?
Is Paolo Di Girolamo. I'm sure he'd be accessible to people. I met him in Rome. Delightful man, very, very honest. And there are still some other people there. Some of them just don't want to talk. Like the famous, well-known Italian aerospace journalist. I've forgotten his name offhand right now, but he himself had lots of encounters with these people, and he took a photograph of the most bizarre craft that's ever been filmed. I think I have it in the book. It is an extraordinary shaped vehicle, if you can call it the vehicle. It looks almost like an animal, and I think that's in the book, as I recall.
Yeah, I found the photo of the alleged giant, right, Mr. Kenio.
Oh, that's the being. Yes, 10 feet tall, and that picture was taken by a Catholic historian, Professor Bruno Samachiccia.
Looks like a human, obviously. No big differences as far as I can see on the surface of it.
No. In fact, I haven't got the chapter in front of me, but there's a great deal, a tremendous amount of physical details about them. They're very, very similar to us in some respects, and the differences are all explained in that chapter, based on what Stefano told me and what he's published. Lot of information. Fascinating. I mean, the fact that they live, I think, up to about 400 to 600 years. And they all said that they'd been here for a very long time, coming and going, on and off.
Okay, so let's try to get a little closer to the title of your book, then, Earth and Alien Enterprise, and the fact that we have our human history, then, is intricately involved with theirs and the different groups that we do have out there.
Yes, yeah. That's it. You've, you've got it in a nutshell. That is true. And you know, many species have a vested interest in this planet. Problem is, we're here. So there is a conflict. There is a conflict situation going on.
And what are we doing here?
What are we doing here?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, can you broaden the question? What are we doing
certainly.
Here?
No, I don't mean to be facetious here, but...
Do you mean, what are we doing about it?
Well, I guess more how did we end up here? And is it a mistake that we are here on the part of those who put us here, I guess?
I guess they all say that we were a hybridized race. What I have learned from other sources, this is quite apart from Amatitsi and people I know who've had extensive communications with these guys, that they hybridized us from primitive man.
Right.
We were genetically upgraded. The primitive men were genetically upgraded, and gradually they became more and more like the human beings that we've seen photographs of in the Amatitsi group.
And do you know of who more directly is responsible for that?
More directly? Do you mean specifically responsible for doing that?
Yeah,
I would say the groups that were the highly advanced spiritually and technologically and everything else, beings who were liaising with all those people around the world at that time for 40 years.
And then at some point along the line here, we have another group, one of the gray types that come into the picture. And as far as I understand it, that then they've managed to kind of settle on the Earth as well, or in the Earth in underground basis.
Under the Earth. Yeah, they have huge underground bases. And they're the ones posing the threat. Now, I have no idea what's going on precisely, but there is a chapter about abductions towards the end. I've forgotten exactly what it's called, but there's information I got from Maria Rivera in Puerto Rico, which is relatively recent, you know, like in the last few years of mm-hmm. her abduction experiences and those of her entire family, which I find entirely convincing. She's a very, very bright lady, very intelligent, very decent. She's a Catholic. She's had some most alarming experiences and served the rest of the family and being taken. And they did one supposedly good thing, but she had a negative outlook on it. But she had cancer, and they apparently got rid of her cancer. But she said that so that they could make more use of her. So she didn't have a very good feeling about all that. I've not been in touch with her for about a year and a half, at least. I couldn't get in touch with her. I've tried. I don't know whether her email's changed or whatever. But a lot has, in any case, been going on in Puerto Rico. I've been to Puerto Rico 7 times. Spent a lot of time, and the people there are very reluctant to talk about it. Maria is an exception. I mean, a lot of people have done research there, some very, very good researchers. And there's an awful lot going, because these guys have taken over the rainforest area, for example, and they have bases, underground bases and undersea locations as well.
Tell us a bit more about the hybridization here, and what you believe is the goal of that. Because what I'm seeing as well, Timothy, then if we were that to begin with, I guess a kind of a blend, genetically upgraded, as you say, it looks uh-huh. like now we have another group that's trying to basically do the same, but with their version of it, right?
Yes, correct. And you can read quite a bit about that at the towards the beginning of the last chapter 19.
Yeah,
I can't remember everything off by heart there, but a friend of mine, a Washington source, gave me details of the hybridization process and precise physical details about these guys. I mean, very precise details.
And why do you? I guess again, I'll return to that question. Why are you prone to believe the sources?
Because the sources I've met, I've known in some cases for 20 years.
Yeah.
One of my Washington sources, and he's straight down the level. And a lot of the information he was reluctant to give, but he over the years, he kindly has done that and has helped me out a great deal.
I mean, it coincides very well with David Jacobs that we had on quite a few years ago now, talking about the hybridization as well.
Yes, I agree with him, absolutely.
You do, huh? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah.
Now, what do you think is the... tell us a little bit more about how you see that this might be actually implemented right now. There are people who speculated that the hybridization process, or the, you know, the mix process, is so far ahead right now at the curve that we literally might have a lot of hybrids already on the planet, walking around, having jobs, you know, an apartment, like the rest of us, if you will.
Well, I can't help you on that because I don't know the state of play regarding that. All I know is that the information I have, and I've published in Chapter 19, is that they were fairly advanced, say back in, I don't know, several decades ago. I have no up-to-date information whatsoever. I have no idea what's going on. But they apparently are continuing to try and develop a crossbreed with which to populate the Earth eventually. That is their goal. Whether they'll get away with it, I don't know. But
sure,
as I say, we have people who have our best interests at heart and their own interests at heart. And I'm saying they're like the Amicizia guys. Whether they're still around, I don't know. But certainly I've had my own encounters over the years with some of these guys.
There are others who are looking out for us or helping us along?
Yes, definitely.
Well, I certainly hope so. If this is the scenario that we're faced with, are we being? And I know that we're speculating here, Timothy, but you know, maybe we can continue to do so a little bit more because it's just interesting. I want to get your take on this. What are we being bred out, or is this a repopulation that is to occur because of there's going to be a massive extinction happening?
I don't know.
No.
But I'll give you, well, you may be familiar. I don't want to go through my more well-known encounters. Like in 1963 was the first with quite a small girl from elsewhere. She was quite remarkable. And unfortunately, I had three witnesses with me when it happened. And that was when I was working with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. And we were touring Germany. We were touring the United States. And I saw this person waiting in line. You can stop me if you've heard it before.
No, go ahead.
I published it before, but I suddenly was alerted. I was with three of my colleagues in the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, and this was the only stop we had in a 512-mile journey from like Tucson, Arizona, to Los Angeles, and we just had this one stop at this diner, and I saw waiting in line, as the Americans say, we say queuing over here, and this extraordinary petite, very alert looking woman she was attractive, but there was nothing really outstanding about her. She was not tall. And I just sent out a mental thought, you know, okay, I said, if you're from elsewhere, could you take the trouble just to step by this table here and prove it to me? When she came out of the line, she was carrying, I don't know if she might have been carrying a cup of coffee or something or other, but she did the most extraordinarily gracious low bow, and my three colleagues were there. We were all looking at her in astonishment. This very sweet smile and a very deep bow, and then she stood up and she went absolutely deadpan expression. She just walked away to the other side of the restaurant. I never forget my friend saying, "What's that all about, Tim?" So, and then the next one was 1967, which probably is the most well-known one. When I was at the Park Sheraton Hotel, working with the London Symphony Orchestra, then in I think it was February of 1967, and somebody had suggested I do some telepathic experiments in New York, in the middle of New York, in this hotel, one afternoon between a rehearsal and a concert. And I sat down and I sent out this thought, if you're any of you guys from elsewhere, this is in my mind, would you please make a point of coming here to this hotel and proving, you know, that you're from elsewhere. So, you know, like about, I thought this is never going to work. But after about 35 minutes, this guy comes in. He looked about, I don't know, mid-30s, I'd say. He was about 5'10", immaculately dressed, fair, wavy hair. I would say a kind of slightly olive complexion. Immaculately dressed, everything, you know, waistcoat, suit and everything. And he looked at me, and then he came down and sat beside me. So I thought, right, here's my opportunity. So in my mind, I said, look, if you're the guy I'm waiting for, would you take your right index finger and hold it to the right side of your nose and keep it there? And no sooner had I thought that than he did that. And as I say, this guy was sitting on the sofa almost next to me, having first sort of, he took out the New York Times from his attaché case and folded it and went, turned the pages over, I thought, quite quickly for if he'd been reading them. And then he folded them, and that was before I asked my question, and I asked for some proof. And I got my proof, but I never spoke to him. People say, why didn't you talk to him? So I've tried talking to, I've had several other experiences. The last one, which I've written, appears, I forget which chapter it's in, I think it might be chapter 9, about infiltration. And this was an experience I had about 8 years ago in Wrocław in Poland, and I was the guest of honor at a prestigious debating salon called Professor Dudek's Salon. And there were about, I don't know, 80 guests, people from all walks of life. There were some military guys there. There were some psychiatrists. There were some politicians. I couldn't tell you who they all were, but I was supposed to give just a 35-minute illustrated presentation. I did that, and then there was a break, and then people could come back after the break. I stayed in the debating salon. I didn't go and have any drinks or anything, or I just stayed put where I was. But throughout the evening, I'd noticed this guy who looked in many cases similar to the chap I'd met in or had encountered in New York. But he was slimmer, slightly smaller, but similar complexion, similar sort of very well contained expression on his face, if you like. Mm-hmm. Hardly, I mean, and I thought, right, I tried a bit of telepathy, but there was no response. But then I thought, people say, why didn't you try and take photographs of these guys, Tim? So I had a camera with me. I started taking this was in the interval when people were sort of coming back, and he was in one part of the room, and I had to take three pictures to encompass the whole, because there were a lot of people there. And as I was about to photograph the area where this guy was sitting, a huge voice boomed out from the back of the salon saying, the speaker's not allowed to take photographs. And I said, oh, I'm terribly sorry. I mean, I don't know who I was saying it to, because there was nobody there. Mm-hmm. And Things continue to happen. I mean, he actually was the last person to give. People were allowed to give like 5 minutes, 6 minutes, something like that. They were to talk that. You know, you were allowed to come to the podium and talk. And the last person to speak was this guy, who I'm absolutely convinced was from elsewhere. And I'll tell you for why.
Yeah.
First of all, the subject of his brief presentation was Earth's future in space, right? And
yep.
He was the last person to speak, finish the whole thing. And afterwards, he got up and he came past me, and I gave him my hand to shake, and he didn't shake it. He just touched it, and he looked at me, and he was not completely unblinking, hypnotic eyes. He looked at me, didn't say a word. I gave him my business card, and then I said something before he went, like, "I think you have a great deal of knowledge." He said absolutely nothing. Then he walked away. Now, fast forward 10 minutes when we were all leaving. I had been put up at a converted hotel, a converted castle, which had been converted into a hotel in outside this city.
Yeah.
We were all going back. And as we assembled in the debating salon, I said, "Who's that guy, the last person to speak?" He spoke about Earth's future in space, didn't he? And everyone said, "Yes, yes, we did." I said, "What did he actually say? What did he talk about?" It was about Earth's future in space. I said, "Yes, I know that, but can you remember what he said?" Nobody. There were about, I was with about a group of, I don't know, 10.
Mm-hmm.
None of them, myself included, could remember what he'd said. Absolutely nothing, except it was called Earth's future in space.
Ah, well, that's bizarre.
How about that? Now, my interpretation of that is, I mean, I could go on. In fact, I will go on after I've told you this. It was subliminal. The information has sunk in there somewhere to be used at some point.
Hmm.
That is my interpretation. But
in a subversive kind of way, or in a good kind of way?
Well, I don't know. I just would like to think he had our best interests at heart. But he was a very cold-looking individual, I have to say. I mean, he was completely expressionless. He didn't blink. He didn't say a word. But a number of interesting things happened. First of all, there was a professional photographer there who took pictures of the audience. He told me that he would get back in touch with me. I gave him my card and everything, and to send the pictures to. I never got the pictures. I could never get in touch with Professor Dudek, who was there, and he's since deceased. There were lots of other people there I couldn't get in touch with. Incidentally, there were two Polish Air Force guys in the audience. I don't want to go into too much detail, but they gave a hard time to the psychologists who were trying to explain rubbish the subject. Mm-hmm. Because one of those pilots had had quite a frightening close encounter with a UFO. But there were a lot of high-powered people there. And I could never... The speaker, by contract, is supposed to have a tape, recorded tape, of the debate. He's supposed to have the photographs. I could never get anything. I could never get a reply from anybody. It was all really bizarre. And that's it, really. I mean, I never saw that guy again. I'm not sure that I'd want to, actually. But I do think it was subliminal, I don't think he would have spoken for that. I don't know how long he spoke. This is another thing. Nobody could remember that, except it was about Earth's future in space. So maybe we are being prepared for something quite serious. I don't know.
Well, that is bizarre. So to me, it feels like we might be used by somebody else, then, that we're being turned into someone's, I don't know, not say property perhaps, but to do the bidding of someone else. I mean, that's, if there are these factions on the planet, Timothy, that are involved in our future, if you will, then they would obviously want to either turn us this way or the other way, right? In their favor.
Yep. I concur. I go along with you on that.
Very bizarre. Very bizarre. You know, in a little while here, we're going to take a short break and carry on. Of course, I wanted to go back and ask about some of the other cases and kind of just break down. We can talk. Let's talk a little bit more about the book, by the way, and the way you kind of formulate it. You break it down, starting in 1932, going all the way up to today, basically, with some of the most interesting cases.
Absolutely, yes.
How did you make your choices? Was there something specific you honed in on, or just like the most that are interesting to you, the most appealing?
The most that were interesting to me, and that I'd invest quite a few that I'd investigated personally. I mean, for example, the Leo Dvorak.
Yeah, the first one there.
I had the pleasure of interviewing him in Helena, Montana. A lovely guy, a very, very interesting guy. He'd been in naval intelligence and everything. And over a period of many years, together with his brother, from 1932 up to the Second World War, when during that war, sadly, Leo's brother died. But those two brothers from back in 1932, they were quite young. They had many encounters with aliens who were regularly dropping in about a mile or so from their farm in Kildare, North Dakota. And eventually, the boys were invited on board the craft, and they were shown, I don't know if they were shown everything, but they were shown a great deal. They were given a tremendous lot of information. They were never actually taken for a trip anywhere, but they came to admire these guys, who treated them extremely well, and it went on for decades. And sadly, as I say, Leo's brother was killed during I think it was the Second World War. And Leo himself continued to have encounters in Montana and I think several other states over a lengthy period. And they learned a great deal, and they grew to respect these people tremendously.
And you see that Leo's story was absolutely honest and from the heart, no problem with it. These guys are not making anything up. They had a real experience.
I think so.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Okay.
And I've spoken to so many other people over the decades. I think in the second chapter, there's a very early missing time case that was reported in 1951 by a guy called Pierre Monnet.
Yes. Yeah.
And he claims to have been, sort of under some kind of force to go to a certain area. Once or twice a week he'd cycle in the small hours to go and see his girlfriend. This was outside Orange in southern France, and on one occasion he just felt compelled in a certain direction. He was taken there. It was almost taken there, and he got there, and there was a very large craft and several human-type aliens, and they gave him a lot of information. And I certainly spent a lot of time with Pierre Monnet, together with a friend of mine from the Philharmonia Orchestra. When we met him in, I think, the 1970s, we met him in Orange, and he's a lovely guy, absolutely genuine, and he certainly was convincing for me and many, many other people, some of them reluctant. I mean, there's I've got a chapter on, I think it's called Reluctant Guinea Pigs.
Yes.
About, for example, Leonard Mantle, who I spent quite a lot of time with interviewing, who he was a gardener in London's West End, and in 1968, stranger introduced himself, eventually claiming that he was an ET, and those meetings went on for several years. But Leonard Mantle told me he became somewhat disturbed by them, but on one occasion he invited this human appearing alien to his home in Clapham in London, and Leonard said, look, you know, the least you can do is to prove. Can you just really prove that you are who you claim to me?
Right.
And the guy gave a very convincing demonstration of levitation in Leonard's home in Clapham in London. And then there was another woman in California, a lady called Barbara Beavers, who in 1977 was invited aboard an alien craft that had touched down not far from her home in Yucca Park, California. That's a fascinating story. There's a great deal of technological detail she was given about the crafts and their occupants, which I find absolutely fascinating. And the story's never been published before.
Ah.
Somebody very kindly gave me a manuscript of it decades ago. And I thought it really, it should be published. And there it is in the book.
Well, fascinating. Let's talk a little bit about how people can get a copy of the book before we take a break here. Sure. Obviously, your website, timothygood.co.
Well, I don't know yet. I would say the best way is definitely through Amazon, because I'm not going to be in a position myself. Sometimes my girlfriend helps me out with these things, you know, to send books here, there, and everywhere. But, you know, the postage is quite excessive from here. So it's much cheaper for people to get the book off Amazon, quite frankly.
Definitely. We're going to have links up to that as well, Timothy. Earth and Alien
Thank
Enterprise.
You.
Yeah, you bet. And then we're going to have to website as well, Timothy. But stay with us here. We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back with more. As we proceed in the second hour for Red Eyes members, we'll get into the story of a former MI6 agent, Pamela Hanford, who overheard a discussion between people in NASA, Buzz Aldrin, and Neil Armstrong, apparently discussing the menacing ships that was present on the moon when they first got there. Timothy also tells us about the somewhat startling off-air comments by Russian Prime Minister Medvedev, who apparently had failed to realize the microphones was still on after an interview, when he said that the president of Russia is given a special top-secret folder that contains information about aliens who visited our planet. We'll get Timothy's take on this. We'll also talk about some of the other interesting cases that Good highlights in the book, and there are some good ones among these, some very bizarre and fascinating ones, as usual. In our radio archives, you can see our upcoming guests, but some of these include Mark Stevens, Russ Baker, Josh Del Sol, Stephen and Evan Strong, James Swagger, and Ingrid Karlqvist, and many more. Continue to listen to Red Eyes Radio as we proceed with much more here in the next couple of days. But if you want to listen to the second hour with Timothy Good coming up right now, and all our previous programs in their entirety, you can acquire a membership at redeyesmembers.com and support an independent online investigative radio program dedicated to bringing you diverse research and opinions on a ton of different subjects. Timothy Good, Hour 2, up next.